Record. All right. So this is Mary Perry. Today's date is 11/24/2009. I'm interviewing Neil O. Hammond about World War II in Korea. So we'll start off a little bit, Mr. Hammond. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, and some of those details.
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, on Edwards Avenue, in the house, on the December 11th, 1925. My father was Stratton Hammond, who's a fairly well-known architect later on. He wasn't too well-known in 1925, but by the 30s he was pretty well-known. And I went to grade school and high school in Louisville. Graduated from the male high school. And of course the war started when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor bombing, I don't remember exactly what year, but I was in high school at the time. And a lot of the boys in our class just went out and enlisted. But my father wasn't going to let me do that. But they enlisted, the next day. And so finished high school in an accelerated course, they called it. So I got off one semester early, graduated. And I went to the University of Illinois. Hmm. And I had three semesters up there. And right before I was 18, I enlisted in the Navy in Springfield, Illinois. And during that period, they had a situation where in the Navy they had a program called the V-12. Mm-hmm. And if you had a year of college, they liked to take you in the V-12, and they would, no matter where you started in college, when you finished your junior year in college, then you would go to midshipman school. Hmm. And the people who had graduated from midshipman school and got commissioned, they were called 90-day wonders in those days. Hmm. And the Army had a program like that too, but they had a little problem. And right before I enlisted in the Navy, all my friends who were in the Army, they all got called up. Mm-hmm. Some of them before they were juniors, and other ones before they'd finished the junior year. Mm-hmm. And the ones that were juniors, they did go to OCS. The ones that were sophomores, they all got they were all privates and sent right on out to. And most of them were in the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. But I finished up my college courses. And of course, we were in the Navy. We were wearing Navy uniforms, and we were being paid $21 a month, like everybody else. Hmm. And we didn't get too much freedom. We had to take a lot of Navy courses, and one thing we had was firefighting. I remember, and they had up in University of Michigan, where I was in the Navy up there, and they had these big sort of artificial lakes, and they'd have water in them, and they put all this oil on them, and they'd set the oil on fire, and we'd have these teams, and we put on our boots and our fireman raincoats and hats and get the hose, and we'd have to go across and put this thing out, you see. And one time the big Ford plant at River Rouge, it was a huge place, it caught on fire, and they actually had our Navy unit going over there and fighting fire at the River Rouge. Hmm. That was the only real service I had at that part in college, where we actually did anything other than study.
So what made you choose the Navy over the Army?
Well, I don't know. I was in the Army ROTC. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the way the Army treated some of my buddies in college, I decided I'd just go in the Navy. Mm-hmm. I liked the water anyhow. I worked on a steamboat when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. On the Ohio and the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't steam, it was actually a diesel boat, but they called them steamboats.
Did you have any brothers or sisters growing up?
Oh, yeah, I had a younger brother and sister. Mm-hmm. But I was the oldest one in the family.
So what did your father say when you enlisted for the Navy?
Well, he thought that was a good idea because he was in the Army at the time. When the war came along, they recruited the architects and engineers and they put them in the Corps of Engineers, and they built these airfields and things, Army bases, and they kept them pretty busy.
Yeah.
And I was familiar with driving a Jeep when I was in high school because I used to go up and visit my dad. He was building the airfield up there in Columbus, Indiana at that time. It was the first one he did.
Yeah.
And then he built one over in Illinois near Vincennes.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the Sturgis. He did one at Sturgis, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. He didn't build an airfield there.
Mm-hmm.
And he extended the runways at Bowman Field and paved them.
Mm-hmm.
Back before the war, Bowman Field was just a grass field.
I didn't know that.
The planes landed in the grass, any direction they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And the old-fashioned way.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I graduated from midshipman school.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me up to New York, to Fort Schuyler.
How old were you then? How old were you then when that happened, when you went up to Fort Schuyler?
And I guess I was 19 when I was commissioned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that was quite a place. This place at Fort Schuyler was where the Coast Guard Academy is. Mm-hmm. It was called Frog's Neck. And there's the bridge right near there. Still there, so far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime during the war, we didn't actually use the Coast Guard facilities. They were still using that. But they built a little wood village there on the property where we had our midshipman school.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there were, let's see, companies A through L, I think, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how many went to midshipman school.
Yeah.
And each company had four platoons, mm-hmm. and each platoon had about 30 men.
Yeah.
So A through L is what, about 12?
100.
Something like that. And that was, I guess it was a battalion. They marched us all around every place. And
so what was training like?
What?
How was your training up there?
Oh, it was kind of tough, but, you know, they missed a lot of push-ups and a lot of all this sort of stuff. Get us in real good shape. And we stayed. They didn't let us off very much. And they weren't giving us any money then because midshipmen, part of our pay had to go to pay for our uniforms. Because the Navy didn't pay for those. We had to pay for those ourselves. Once you become an officer,
The
Navy doesn't pay for a lot.
No.
They give you your pay, and then you're supposed to pay for your other
really?
Needs.
What about for your housing and for your food? Did they cover that?
They gave us the food allowance,
okay.
But we had to buy our own food.
So how was the food back then?
Oh, it was. I thought it was all right.
Yeah.
It was plain food, but it was good food.
Yeah. So you lived in barracks and.
Yeah, but particularly when you're in the States, it was always pretty fair.
Yeah.
I graduated from midshipman school, and while I was there, I was having been in the Army, ROTC. I knew what some of the good sweet jobs were.
Yeah.
And so I volunteered to become the guide on.
What's that?
Well, the guide on, they have company officers, you see, just like in West Point and Annapolis. And then they have platoon leaders, and they have platoon sergeants, and they have all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the best job in the world is the guide on. Because
what is that?
Being the guide on, you can't march with your company. You don't march with your platoons, or you don't do any of that sort of stuff. What you do is you carry this little flag. It has a company flag.
Yeah.
And then you walk around in front of the company, and then when you stop and they go out to drill, when the officers stop, well, I used to sit under a tree while they're drilling. Not only that, but if you're the guide on, you already have a duty, so they don't try to point you as a platoon leader or squad leader or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm immune to all those jobs.
Yeah, you got it figured out.
So it wasn't too bad going through midshipman school. And we had all this Navy stuff. They had textbooks, Navy printed. I still have some of them at home.
So what'd you study there?
Oh, we studied gunnery
and
trajectory
mm-hmm.
and ships damage and the type of ships and Morse code and communications and you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Rules of the road for the Navy.
Yeah. What are the
navigation
rules?
Navigation. Yeah. And all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So you were there as a midshipman?
90 days.
90 days?
90-day wonder, yeah.
Okay.
So then they took us over to the cathedral, the Episcopal Cathedral over New York City, and gave us all gave us all our bars and said, okay.
Is that the Washington Cathedral, the big one?
No, it was in New York.
Okay, New York. City. That's not D.C. Okay.
Took down New York City. And the and then they gave us a little leave, and then we all got on a We really met our bunch. We met in Chicago. Some of the guys were from Chicago and Louisville and Pennsylvania and all around different places.
Yeah.
And some of the people had been in my there was one fellow named Larry Moore who was in my company. He wasn't in my platoon, but he was in my company. And he became a good friend. We were both sent to the USS Montpelier.
Okay. What year was that?
That was in 1945.
Okay.
And so we went out on a train, of course, a bunch of Naval, mostly we had Navy officers on this train.
From Chicago to?
From Chicago to San Francisco.
Oh, that's
awesome. We had a couple of Russians. We had three Russians.
Really?
And they they really kept us... We gave the Russians an LST, and they were going to get the LST and take it to Vladivostok.
Now, what's an LST?
It's a ship that's a landing craft ship. It's,
okay.
You can put tanks and trucks and things in it. The big door comes down the front.
I see those.
Anyhow, so we got on the train, and here they are. And this is one of those trains where the seats make into beds, you know, what do you call them, sleepers. And they never made the bed up, and they had a case of vodka right down there by their feet, and they never left it. There was always somebody sitting there with his foot over the case of vodka, and they drank vodka the whole way. And we were watching them all the way out. In 2 or 3 days, they were just about empty, and we thought, "Hi, what are they going to do now?" You know, but guess what? Got to Salt Lake City, and all of a sudden another case of vodka mysteriously appeared. I don't know where
Utah?
They got it. Yeah, I don't know how they ever got that thing. And so they were laughing at us because here they have another case of vodka. That, and they wouldn't give us the drop. But, of course, we could go to the club car and get a drink.
Yeah.
But then we got to San Francisco. And while we were waiting for a ship, I don't know, we were there. They put us in the German-American Bund building.
Oh, really? In San Francisco?
In San Francisco. And it was really a great place to stay. It was sort of like the Penn Dentist Club here.
I've been there,
you know. Really a nice spot to stay. Had, you know,
elegant.
Pool tables and nice dining room and all this sort of stuff. And our only jobs there, they made us load troop ships. And we'd go down the docks and all these soldiers would come marching up with their bags. And they wanted officers to sign the bunks. I guess they read
signed the bunks.
Assigned bunks.
Oh, assigned bunks. Okay.
We'd have all these soldiers who say, "Okay, that's your bunk," and then we'd have his name there, and we put the bunk number down. That's all we did. But they wanted officers because they afraid these guys wouldn't pay attention to to enlisted man.
This is a school interview, so we'll just keep on with ours. But
so anyhow, we did that for a while, and then they finally put us on the CVE-1, which was the Long Island.
CVE-1,
and CV designates a small carrier, and one designates the first one ever built.
Okay.
And strangely enough, we had this friend named Zachariah. He was not Lebanese. What is the other people live out near Turkey? Armenian.
Armenian.
He was an Armenian fellow, and his uncle owned this famous restaurant in San Francisco called the Omar Khayyam.
Oh my!
And we got to have free dinners over there a couple of times.
That was nice.
But he was on the ship's company, so most of us, they put us in what appeared to me to been perhaps the chief's quarters, on one that was a fighting carrier.
Yeah.
And the junior officers were going, they were just being transported over mm-hmm. to the Pacific.
Okay.
We were all bunked in this
transport,
in this chief's quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And but since we knew a kit ship's officer, he'd bring us up to the ward room once in a while. So we got a little special treatment going over
there. Nothing wrong with that.
And this CVE-1, they were taking planes over for to the fighting carriers.
Hmm.
But they had about, I don't know exactly how many, but I'm going to guess and say 6 to 8 pilots on board.
Yeah.
And what they were supposed to do was to, if the Japs attacked,
mm-hmm.
they were going to throw all these front planes overboard and take off on these fighters to protect the ship.
Hmm.
And that's why we had some pilots on board. And we went right by Truck Island.
Mm-hmm. Where's Truck Island?
It's out in the Pacific.
Okay.
It was one of the islands that we hadn't taken, full of Japs.
Yeah.
And of course, along the way out there, we stopped at a few places. Hawaii, mm-hmm. and we stopped at Kwajalein.
Yeah.
And we stopped at Aniwetok.
What are your memories of those places?
Oh, great. You know, we couldn't drink on board ship. Mm-hmm. And so we'd stop in those islands. We'd run over to the officers' clubs and get filled up with beer as fast as we could.
Yeah.
And one time I decided I'd go swimming. Mm-hmm. I took swimming trunks over there.
In Hawaii?
No, this was on one of those islands. I don't remember if it was Aniwetok or mm-hmm. what it was. One of those islands that we stopped in. And I was very sorry I did that because the coral was just terrible.
You cut
your feet and everything over there. So I discovered that the islands weren't a very good place. The beaches looked pretty good, but once you got down in there, you'd get caught up in that with that coral.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to get from San Francisco over to the Montpellier?
Oh, well, it took a long time
because
from it took, I don't know how long to cross the ocean there. Mm-hmm. Probably it took two and a half, maybe three weeks. I don't know what it cost to get across there.
Yeah. Did you ever get seasick?
No.
Okay.
I'm pretty good that way. I never got too seasick or airsick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was an exception one time. I was full of beer.
Oh, that makes a difference.
Yeah. But the we got to the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
and
what part of the Philippines did you go to?
They put us off on a little island called Samar,
mm-hmm.
and there was a little base there, a Navy base.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only there one night, and they sent us to a place called Tacloban,
mm-hmm.
and they had another base there. And so I got to Tacloban, and we lived in a little tent city.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the officers' tents over here and the enlisted men's tents over there and the chief's tents over there.
Mm-hmm.
And this people were coming and going through this place.
Yeah.
And, of course, we checked in, and they said, well, we don't know where your ship is. I'm going to go into the Montpelier. Said, we don't know where your ship is. And Larry Moore and I were both going there.
Mm-hmm.
And said, "But and it doesn't look like we'll know for a while. So we need somebody. So we're going to sign you a little duty while you're here." So they made me the shore patrol officer. And that wasn't too bad a job because they told me just frankly, said, there's nothing really to patrol except the officers' club. He said,
yeah.
He said, you go over the officers' club, make sure everybody behaves themselves at the officers' club. That's your big duty. I said, okay. So I went in the morning, the chief come over and get me in a Jeep. Mm-hmm. Officers weren't supposed to drive, you know.
Oh, really?
No, you're supposed to always have a driver, somebody drive you. He'd come over and pick me up in the Jeep, and then we'd go get the two enlisted men we had. There were only four of us at shore patrol at this base. And we'd take these two enlisted men over to the enlisted man's club, where they were playing baseball and drinking beer and everything.
Yeah.
And they were the shore patrol officers over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the chief would take me down to the officers' club.
Yeah.
And then he'd go to the chief's club.
Yeah. What the officers' club looked like?
Well, it wasn't too bad a place. It mm-hmm. looked like all of them out there. They weren't real big.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if they had a floor in them or not. Yeah. They might have been sand.
Yeah.
But they all had a roof on them over there because it used to rain a lot in the Philippines.
Yeah. Was it pretty hot there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very hot.
Yeah.
And the Our bartender was a Filipino, and he spoke excellent English, really good. And I asked him, I said, what did you do before you were a bartender? And he said, I was a college professor at the University of Manila.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, that's a pretty prestigious job. I said, what are you doing being a bartender now? He said, well, he said, I couldn't resist. He said, the pay was so good.
Yeah, more than a professor, huh?
And so anyhow, I was over there, and it seemed like 2 months, but I don't think it was that long.
Yeah.
But it was quite a while. And I'm the shore patrol officer, and I didn't have, you know.
Anything exciting
happened. We had these fellows who came over and would come over, and they were all gung-ho, and they wanted to play volleyball or do this or that. And they'd get out there, and it was 110 in the shade, you know. That wouldn't last long.
Yeah.
And then some of them, they were going to hunt Japs. See, there were these there's jungles right outside the camp. We'll go up in that hill and get some Japs here, you know.
There weren't any there?
Oh, there were Japs up there, but they go in about 100 yards to get lost.
Yeah.
Get their clothes all torn off.
Yeah, come back.
Staring at you.
Yeah.
While I was there, the war ended,
mm-hmm.
which was nice.
Yeah. Now, what year was that?
1945.
Okay. So what did you do then?
So you can see I had a lot of action there in World War II.
Yeah. Didn't see any big battles or anything.
Yeah. And so then
Were there some of the songs that you all sang there in World War II?
Oh, probably some of the songs, yeah.
Yeah.
But while I was there, of course, all I had to do is socialize with all the guys at the officers' club.
Mm-hmm.
And I got friendly with some of these pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are flying these PBMs.
What's a PBM?
PBM is a twin-engine flying boat made by Martin Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big, big seaplane. You know, a hull-type seaplane.
Yeah.
It had a kitchen in it, galley, and two bunks.
Yeah.
And pretty good-sized ship. And these seaplanes were mostly carrying around mail and cargo and things.
Yeah.
They originally were, you know, designed to be scout planes too, so these fellows there said, "Hey, you're just a transit." Said, "Why don't you just come on with us?"
Hmm.
And I thought, "Well, you know, that's not a bad idea. I get to see a little world, maybe."
Mm-hmm.
So, I got my friend Larry Moore, and we got on this plane, and we went up to Okinawa, And at Okinawa, we discovered there are a lot of ships in Shanghai, and there are a lot of ships up in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we ought to go one to one of the other places to find our ship.
Yeah.
So I said, come on, Larry, let's go to Shanghai. That's bound to be the best.
Yeah.
He said, no, he said, the chances are our ship's in Japan. He said, I'm going to Japan. We had a bet to see who got on our ship first.
Yeah.
And he won the bet, but I had the most fun.
Yeah.
Because we flew over to Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane landed in the Wangpu River.
Mm-hmm.
And Shanghai was really something to see in those days.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable place. I've never seen anything like it before or since.
Mm.
And they parked the plane anchored out in the river. And we hadn't been there but 10 minutes. And here comes a big old Chinese boat over there. And these guys are selling everything.
Yeah.
Including girls.
Right.
So there were three enlisted men who had to stay on the plane.
Yeah.
In case it broke
off the boat. Broken into.
So they decided they'd buy a girl. So.
Mm-hmm. Stay on the plane with them.
Yeah,
huh?
Stay on the plane with them.
Yeah.
And so I went to the seaplane tender.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't stay on the seaplane tender very long. I went ashore with all these guys.
Sure, you want to have a check out the city.
Check out the city, right. And
So did you have to get permission to take off on this plane to go to Shanghai?
No, I'm a transit.
Okay.
I'm signing out. See?
Yeah.
I'm looking for my...
You're
but
both.
Any while I'm a transit, now I'm under the command of this guy,
mm-hmm.
the fellow who runs this aviation outfit.
Okay.
I have to do anything he says.
Yeah.
But I'm still a transit.
Yeah.
But we went ashore, and I bought a nice Leica camera.
Yeah.
For, I think $100 or something.
Yeah.
Pretty good buy.
Mm-hmm.
And
took a lot of pictures.
No, I didn't have any film at the time. Mm. I bought the camera, but I couldn't buy film.
Well, that's interesting.
I know it. Well, Shanghai was really different.
Mm.
Along the riverbank,
mm-hmm.
I guess about 30 yards at. The boats were just packed. All these junks are just packed in there. And these people, I don't see how any of them ever get out of there. They're just, you know, packed one boat after the other. And these people living on these boats, they have children and pigs and goats and all this stuff.
It smelled really good.
Anyhow, but
never seen anything like that in Kentucky.
Not quite like that.
Yeah.
And so in town they had these hotels, and they were very modern hotels, very nice hotels. You go in there and get a scotch and water, whatever, or dinner or whatever.
Yeah.
And they had three kinds of money. You had Chiang Kai-shek money, and you had something called CNC, and then they had the Jap money. The Japs are still walking around the streets directing traffic and everything. They hadn't gotten around to locking up the Japs yet.
Wow.
And when I got there. And, of course, when you went someplace, you got a rickshaw.
How was that?
Oh, that was interesting. And you could get a rickshaw ride or anywhere around. We used to give them a dime, and they were very happy with a dime.
Really? American dime?
American dime, yeah. Silver dime. They liked those, that silver.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the, keep them all day for a quarter.
Wow.
And so about the second day we were in Shanghai, I went ashore with a bunch of these ship's officers, these pilots, you know. And this one fella said, we need some better transportation than these rickshaws. So he had this idea. We went down to this really fancy bar across from the racetrack. And we waited for a good Jeep to come by. He said, you know how to drive a Jeep? I said, I can drive one. He said, okay. He said, you're going to be the driver. We had a lookout, and there was three of us.
Yeah.
And our instigator, our leader, and this colonel came in with a real nice-looking, clean Jeep, and Army colonel.
Army. And everybody else is Navy.
Yeah, well, we were Navy. And Army guy came in with his nice Jeep, and he had a chauffeur. And he went in this bar. We put the lookout on the bar, and then the chauffeur decided he was going to another bar, so he went way down the street for a bar. They took the rotor out of the Jeep. That's the thing on top of the distributor and the rotor.
Yeah.
So that nobody could, so it wouldn't work.
Sure.
Well, our guy had a rotor.
He was prepared.
He lifted the hood, put a rotor on. He says, okay, start her up. I start up, and he whistled for the other guy, and we all jumped in.
Shanghai.
Yeah. So, this guy took it down to the docks and had it painted white, put stenciled U.S. Navy all over it, you know, and put a big long number.
Oh, no.
So we had a little Jeep for a while. But everybody got a little bit disturbed because I didn't have any duty. They all had duty. Yeah. They had watches. You know, they only go to the shore every third day or something.
Yeah.
You know.
You had duty.
I'm ashore all the time.
Yeah.
I'd go back to eat, watch out of the ships.
Yeah.
And these guys were getting very envious of me.
Yeah.
So the commander saw that wasn't going to work too well. So he put me back on another plane and sent me back to Okinawa.
Yeah. Was Larry with you on this?
No, Larry was already in Japan.
Oh, okay.
He was already on the Helena.
Okay.
And we got back there, and they had a big, first thing they did, we lost a plane. They had a plane in there. It wasn't the plane I was on, it was another plane. And it had just been overhauled, and they put a $1 million radar set on it. It was very rare to have radar on a plane in those days. And these guys sunk the plane. It was I imagine the pilot was pretty embarrassed about that. But we were on another plane. And what they used to do, these airplanes would, they had a little hatch in the back. And where the tail part came out, it raised out of the water, and there was a hatch there, and they'd open up that hatch, and that would let the air come in, and then they'd open up the hatches on the top, so it would ventilate, so it wouldn't get so hot in those airplanes.
Yeah.
And this plane broke off the buoy, and the wind blew it back a little bit, and this guy started the engines to taxi up, and the guy in the front, he was supposed to reach out and hook on the buoy, and he missed the buoy. And when he missed the buoy, the pilot got kind of PO'd, and he shoved the throttles in. When he did that, the plane raised up like that, and all the water started coming into that hatch, which was still open. Nobody closed it.
Oh, dear.
And this plane started going like this. And we had the mail boat right next to us, unloading mail. that we were going, they were going to take someplace. Mm. And the mail boat went over there, and everybody got out on the wing. Mm-hmm. Walked down the end of the wing, and here's the wing out here, and the mail boat pulls up, and they start walking into the mail boat down mm-hmm. the wing. Yeah. And as the last fellow jumped in the mail boat, plane quack, right down the bottom of the ocean. And just a new $1 million radar set.
Throw away the money.
But the war was over, so.
Yeah.
They probably junked it anyhow.
Yeah, maybe.
So anyhow, I finally got a ride up to Japan. Mm-hmm. And they had this big, I've forgotten to tell you about the big wind they had. Mm-hmm. Big typhoon came through there. Mm. And I was out in a small boat.
Is that still in 1945 then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I was in the small boat, mm-hmm. and I'd gone in. The mail boat was going in. I went on this airplane. When they have all these seaplanes, they have mm-hmm. Airplane retriever, a ship. Mm-hmm. It's real low. Sort of looks like a destroyer.
Okay.
It takes care of the planes. And that's where we lived on that.
Yeah.
And so the mailman was going to take some mail into the shore. And I mm-hmm. thought, well, I've never been to Okinawa. I guess I'll go in and maybe get a couple of beers, you mm-hmm. know. And so I went in there and had a few beers. And I got on the boat again when he was going back out. And this was a little boat. It wasn't mm-hmm. even probably, maybe 16, 18 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't anything to speak of. We got out, and all these ships started going out of the harbor. Mm. We knew there was something going on. We raced as fast as we could, and the waves got really high, and they were just all over everything. We finally got back there and got this boat, pulled it boat on board, and they had a typhoon come through there.
Oh, my.
But it didn't last too long.
Yeah.
And the Montpelier, the ship I was on, mm-hmm. they were in a little harbor up in Japan.
Okay.
And they dragged they had their anchor out, and they understood it. They dragged this cruiser that pulled the anchor about a mile across the bottom of the bay.
Mm.
And it ripped up all the transportation cables that the Japs had in the end of the water.
Mm.
And when I got up there, about 2 days later, I got a plane up to Wakayama, was mm-hmm. the name of the place, Japan.
Yeah.
And I got a plane up there, and they had one of the LSTs mm-hmm. that they had in that harbor.
Mm-hmm.
They washed them all the way up the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
It was something to see.
Yeah.
But our ship had been up there getting some prisoners,
mm-hmm.
and they had a hospital ship there, and they got all these prisoners and brought them over to our ship, checked out these guys. Mm-hmm. For some reason, don't ask me why they brought them to our ship, because then they took them to the hospital ship anyhow.
Yeah.
And so then...
Yeah, this was on the Montpelier.
I'm on the Montpelier,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm in the junior officer's bunk room with my friend mm-hmm. Larry Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost a bet, and I owed him a carton of cigarettes. And so I went down to the gee-dunk stand and...
Mm-hmm.
and Got a carton of cigarettes from my friend Larry. Of course, cigarettes in those days cost 50 cents a carton.
Yeah.
And it was still that way in the Korean War because there weren't any tax on them.
Yeah.
So I gave him his bet.
Mm-hmm.
And
I bet you had a better time in Shanghai.
Yeah, I had a better time in Shanghai. He was just living in a junior officer's bunk room.
Yeah.
And so that I became acquainted with the ship, and I was assigned as a junior officer in the 2nd Division.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2nd Division is a gunnery division.
Mm-hmm.
And they had several junior officers. And when I first started out, they had too many junior officers. And my first GQ duty, and we were just practicing, of course, because mm-hmm. the war was over then.
Yeah.
And they'd bring these airplanes would carry what they call sleeves, and we'd mm-hmm. shoot at these sleeves mm-hmm. for practice, you know.
Right.
They put me on a 40-millimeter director, which was the worst job in the ship.
Really? Why is that?
Well, they have, it's this particular one I was situated on, was situated up in the superstructure, and when the 5-inch gun was firing up this way, mm-hmm. I could reach out and put my hand on the barrel. Mm. So every time this 5-inch gun, they're twin fives, mm-hmm. every time these two 5-inch guns would fire, it would lift me up and throw me back against the bulkhead. Mm-hmm. And these 40 millimeter directors didn't have any protection. Mm-hmm. They gave you no protection because they were just like shooting a 20 millimeter machine gun or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you're out in the open.
Yeah.
They were things to put your arms in and, you know.
Hold on to it.
Hold on and move it around and push the buttons and all that. But I but I only had that for a while. That one of the guys, I guess, got transferred off the ship, and I became the turret officer in turret number 3. Mm. And that's where for the remainder of my time on the Montpelier, that was my main job. Mm. Now that was pretty good duty. I liked the turrets much better.
Yeah.
You weren't outside. You're behind about 14 inches of solid steel.
Yeah, a little protection.
Yeah, and the funny thing about the turrets is they were noisy because you had a lot of motors in there, mm-hmm. for the hoist and lift and turning the guns and all that. So it was pretty noisy, but it wasn't that noisy. But mm-hmm. when they fired the guns, you couldn't hear them because of all the sounds outside the turret.
Well, that's helpful for your ears.
Yeah, and you couldn't tell when the guns fired unless you were watching them. And we had three 6-inch guns in each turret. Mm-hmm. And of course, they'd recoil about a yard or yard and a half.
Yeah.
They'd come back that far when you fired them.
Yeah. So how long did you do that then?
The rest of the time I was on the Montpelier. That was my station.
Yeah. So how long was that?
Well, I got on in, I guess, maybe September of 1945.
Yeah.
And I got off in August of 46.
Okay, so about a year.
Yeah. But soon as I hadn't been on Montpelier too long, and maybe a day or two, mm-hmm. and we took off. We left this port, the Wakayama, and we sailed down through the Inland Sea, and we were assigned to be the, what do you call it? We were assigned to be in charge of the Navy base, mm-hmm. which was
is that near Japan or
in Japan? Okay. Yeah, the Navy base in Japan, and their Annapolis place was right there.
Okay,
and what was the name of that place? I'll think of it in a minute. Okay. And also Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. Hiroshima was one of our places that we were in charge.
Did you go look at that?
Did I ever? We had a little. This is sort of a funny story. We had decided when we first got there, we all wanted to go down there and look at Hiroshima. So we had these Liberty boats, and the place where we were anchored was 5 miles or so from Hiroshima. And so we all started down there, and all these Liberty boats, and we all got ashore, and we went up the hill. Yeah. We got up there, and we were quite surprised and delighted to find that when the bomb hit, it hadn't destroyed the brewery.
Oh.
And the brewery, and all these guys, all these Japanese were up there and with these beer trucks.
Yeah.
And they had these little tables, stretched out there at the top of the landing when we were selling beer.
Hmm.
And we thought that was great.
There was any danger of radiation there?
Oh, we didn't pay much attention to it.
Yeah, didn't stay there that long.
It didn't bother us, and nobody told us there was anything wrong with it. And nobody didn't seem to hurt anybody anyhow.
Yeah. But what did it look like there?
Well, the Hiroshima was pretty well bombed out. Mm-hmm. Of course, the other place was too, and one I can't
Nagasaki.
Think of the name of, huh?
Nagasaki?
No. The other town that went down the road where that we are occupied. Both of them were completely flat and burned up.
Yeah.
And they had burned up streetcars, and they had, most of the buildings were wood in there, so they didn't leave much.
How long is it since they dropped the bomb till the time that you saw were there at Nagasaki? I mean, was it like a month or two?
Two or three weeks.
Oh, just 2 or 3 weeks afterwards.
Maybe not that, 2 weeks maybe.
Okay, so it's still looking pretty.
2 or 3 weeks, I'd say.
Yeah.
And the place, they say, was pretty well bombed. There was one building in the middle of town, right in the center, that was still standing. It was a reinforced concrete office building, best I could tell.
Yeah.
And it was still up, but everything else was pretty well bombed out.
Yeah.
And then around the side on the, I think it was the west side, there was a hospital. Mm-hmm. And the hospital was damaged, but it was still being used. And when you got about, half a mile, three quarters of a mile, then the buildings were, some places would be damaged, some places would be all right.
Right.
And the first day we got there, one thing these guys did, they drank all this beer, all these sailors. Mm-hmm. And somebody found out that they'd ordered the Japanese to put all their weapons away, you know, turn them in.
Yeah.
And somebody said, well, they had to turn them in someplace. And they found out where the armory was. They went in there and they got in the armory. And I went over there myself. And they were, all these sailors, they were just taking anything they wanted to in the armory.
You could take souvenir guns.
They were taking pistols and rifles and machine guns and anything.
Yeah. Did you get
swords,
anything?
And I don't remember what I brought back, but I think I brought back a sword. From there.
Yeah.
But so we all came back that evening. Mm-hmm. Everybody's been drinking beer and everybody's carrying a weapon. And it looked like a bunch of pirates. I mean, had ammunition over their shoulders and everything.
Yeah.
And the captain was furious. Oh, he was really.
Really?
He was really PO'd about the whole thing.
Hmm.
And so he ordered everybody, he said, you got to go to the fantail, drop all your weapons.
Oh, my.
And so they piled them all up back there.
Hmm.
And, of course, at this army, I'm not kidding you, they had weapons piled up, just in piles, huge piles of weapons.
Huh.
And swords and machine guns, anything you can think of.
Huh.
And, so they piled all this stuff on in the back of the ship, piled it all up. And then they counted it and so forth, and they found out how many men were on our ship, and then, so they decided that everybody's going to get a souvenir.
Okay.
And they draw lots for them or something. I've forgotten what they
really?
Did.
Huh.
But so all the men on the ship, including myself, we got one souvenir.
Yeah.
And
So what'd you end up with?
I got a rifle, real nice rifle. Not too valuable, but So we stayed in that area for quite a while, and we had our little island that we took over that was not too far from the ship. It was much closer than going to one of these other places we could go. And we had a little, it was an estate, somebody's estate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had one place where the enlisted men could go play baseball and drink beer, and the officers had another little spot over at another place. And it wasn't a building or anything. It was just sort of a pagoda or something.
Yeah, hang out.
And we'd have to take our own beer over there, of course. And
so we'd
go over there a lot of times in the afternoons, you know, for recreation. And the but it was kind of interesting. The Japanese were really afraid of us when we got in there. They thought we were going to cut their heads off, I think.
Really?
Oh, yeah, they were. They would just bow down and back up.
So you didn't have any threat from them then?
No.
You weren't threatened?
No. They would, you know, just got to their house, they'd invite you in and stay out of your way and let you walk around and all that.
But what was your accommodations like on the boat? What did it look like?
Well, it depended. When I first started out, I was in the junior officer's bunk room. And we had these iron cots. There were three of them in a row. There were the middle one and the upper, a middle one and a lower.
Yeah.
And they were held up by chains.
Hmm.
And there were two of them together like this.
Yeah.
All the way up, held up by these chains. And And then they had a mattress, of course, on them.
Yeah.
And by the sides on them were two pipe rails, mm-hmm. which were approximately, I guess, 8 inches apart.
Yeah.
Going around. So that when a ship was rolling, you wouldn't fall out.
A bit, yeah.
Although one time it was rolling so much, I did fall out. They could have made them a little higher, I guess.
Yeah.
But the poor enlisted man, of course, they only had one rail.
Yeah.
And a very, very slim little mattress. Mm. They didn't have anything to keep them from falling out.
Yeah. So did you have like a bathroom in there, or was it
no,
separate?
No, we'd have a... we had a sink in there, mm-hmm. but junior officers and even up to lieutenant commanders and things, nobody had a private bathroom except the captain and maybe the exec.
Yeah.
We had these communal
showers.
Heads. We called them heads.
Yeah.
And there'd be showers and toilets and so forth. Like a big fraternity house.
Yeah. Where'd you store your clothes and how do you keep your clothes nice?
We had these lockers, just metal lockers, to keep our clothes in.
Yeah. Did you have to do your own laundry, or did the ship do your laundry?
No. All the ships had laundries.
Okay.
Yeah. We'd send the laundries, though. We were never sure if we ever get our own stuff back or not, but we usually got back the same amount of things we sent in.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah. You see, we used to have problems we had so much problem with clothes, we didn't even pay attention to it. Because, if you went to an officer's club, say a big officer's club, and there would be three cruisers there, so there'd be maybe 300 officers, and everybody had the same coat and everybody had the same hat.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you going to do? Well, you just put one on and fit.
Take it.
You know.
Yeah.
So then we stayed in Japan until about the middle of November, best I can remember.
Yeah.
And it was a little before Thanksgiving because we had a very peculiar thing happen on Thanksgiving. We got our orders back to the States.
Yeah.
And we took off. And when we got to the international dateline, it was Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And so, according to naval regulations, we had everybody on the ship, not just the officers. Everybody on the ship had turkey, cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, dressing, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And the Navy Department in Washington had designated this as what you must give to everybody on Thanksgiving.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so we all had that.
Well, that was good.
And the...
in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, in the middle of the ocean. But the funny thing was, the next day, we crossed the international dateline.
Right.
So it was Thanksgiving again.
Oh, again.
So we had two Thanksgivings.
They had to give it to you twice.
So the same thing.
You didn't argue about it, though.
We couldn't argue about it, man. These are naval regulations.
Yeah.
That's what it says you have to have. That's what you have to have.
Yeah.
So we all had the same thing again, exactly.
Yeah. Did you have much trouble with people getting in trouble and having to go to the brig or anything like that while you were on board?
Well, there wasn't too much trouble you can get into when you're on board ship.
Yeah.
Now, during the Korean War, we did have one incident I can remember. And the crew members had a poker game going, and one of the Marine guards had a .45. He was on guard duty. The only time you ever have a weapon, if you carry a weapon, is if you're on guard duty.
Yeah.
In the Navy, you never are on if you're the officer of the day. You're on guard duty. You carry a weapon. Otherwise, you don't carry any weapon.
Yeah.
And he had his .45, and they got in a big argument, and this guy shot one of his buddies with a .45. And the bullet went through this guy and didn't hit an artery, a vein, or bone, or an organ.
That's a miracle.
The doctor said he couldn't believe it. He said he couldn't push a big knitting needle through a band, not hit anything. He said, but this bullet went through and didn't hit anything.
Yeah.
They put two Band-Aids on him, and he was back to work the next day.
Oh, my. So that was a problem.
Which was amazing.
Yeah. So you were traveling across during Thanksgiving, and then you went back to the States?
On the back, so we went all the way back. We stopped on the West Coast, let a bunch of people out that had on leave that lived out there.
Yeah.
And then we went on through the Panama Canal. We went through the Panama Canal on my birthday.
How was that? How was that in December?
It was terrible. Really? Awful.
It was hot. It was really rough and rocky.
It was hot. I mean, to tell you, and we had to be on deck. I was on the second division. Yeah. We had to handle lines.
Mm.
And so everybody in our division was on deck all day.
Mm.
And so we got the awful sunburns.
Yeah. So how old were you when you traveled through the Panama Canal?
Pardon?
How old were you then?
Well, 20? I guess I must have been 20. That must have been my 20th birthday.
Yeah.
And so we finally got through the canal.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble, we could have gotten through it pretty quickly, but we had all these slow boats we had to wait for. You know, here we're a cruiser. We can make 30 knots from any trouble. We've got all these old clunkers out there.
Seven knots. You couldn't run them over, so.
But they wouldn't let us, you know, they won't move you up in line.
Yeah, you just have to go.
We just have to go in, you know, in order.
Yeah, so it was a lot of traffic going through there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so anyhow, so but then we got out to the, into the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
and we were going, next place we were going to Guantanamo, Cuba.
Yeah.
And about, I had to mid-watch between, and I was in the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I was assistant officer on the bridge there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on watch, and it really, really got rough. It's the roughest sea I think I've ever seen on a ship in my life.
Mm.
And the waves were coming, not just breaking over the bow, but they were breaking right over the bridge.
That's a lot.
And it was awful.
Mm.
And, you know, I went, after I got relieved, I went down and went to bed, went to sleep.
Mm.
Next morning I got up, and the sun was shining, and the wind. Just like being in a bathtub. It was just all smooth and everything.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. But it was just for that 4-hour stretch, it was just terrible.
Rough,
I'm suspecting it was somewhere south of Jamaica. Because the next morning we pulled into Guantanamo.
Yeah. How was Guantanamo then? How was Cuba then?
Well, we didn't spend any time there.
Okay.
We went in there, and I don't know what we went there for, but we went in there for a day or maybe.
Yeah.
And then we headed up to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, now it's in December.
It's cold, and you've been in this heat. Now
and we've been out in the South Pacific. But
sunburned.
And all sunburned from the Panama Canal. and we went on up the East Coast, and we stayed out in the Gulf Stream where we got some current to help us along.
Right.
And the... And when you're in the Gulf Stream, it's amazing. It doesn't get cold out there.
Really?
In the Gulf
Stream. Heat over there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And we were in shirt sleeves. We got opposite New York. Then
in
we
December.
Had to turn. Then we had to turn out of the Gulf Stream and go into into the harbor. And we got in New York, and it was cold, bitter cold, snowing, carrying on. And we almost ran the ship aground. That wasn't my fault, though. I'm just a junior officer. You know? I was down in CIC on watch at the time.
Yeah.
And the captain actually had to drop anchor, keep us from running aground,
because
he was off course, and we were,
that's not good.
Yeah, down near the Narrows there.
Yeah.
But anyhow, we finally got in to Brooklyn Navy Yard. And everybody got to go home.
Yeah.
Except me.
Really?
There
Why
were
didn't
four
you
of us on the ship.
Huh.
And I was the most junior of the junior officers still.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got to go but me. There were four officers left on that ship.
Oh, my.
On Christmas.
Oh.
I was one of them.
Oh.
And but we had a good time there in New York. The ship went in the Navy Yard, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, that was where they overhauled the ship, you know. And they fixed everything up that needed fixing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we were in there till about February, I guess, getting fixed up.
So you couldn't go home at all?
Oh, yeah, I did finally get home,
okay.
But not at Christmas.
Yeah.
I think I got home after New Year's.
Okay. So you had New Year's Eve at age 20 in New York City?
I think so, yeah. And, of course, all the girls I knew were gone at Christmas. But after Christmas, they all came back. And I had a lot of girlfriends around there.
In New York?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was an expensive place.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used to go home with my friend Larry Moore. He lived in Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And
wasn't too far then.
We could get on a train on Friday and be there Friday evening and party Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
Get on a train Sunday afternoon and
be
go
back.
Back to the ship.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get to Louisville.
Right. It's too far.
Too far.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we were enjoying that.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they finished with the overhaul, they put us over on Pier 52. And that was even better because we were over there on the in the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
And we were about two blocks from all those joints in Greenwich Village.
Oh, yeah.
And they had one place I just loved. It was called Nick's.
Hmm.
And they had Muggsy Spanier played there. And they had all the jazz guys in New York, of course, in those days. I went out and saw Billie Holiday.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And all cool. those. That one was kind of a... I think she was past her peak, though, by then.
Okay.
And,
that's pretty exciting.
So it was a nice place, except it was hard on our bank account. See, we didn't get paid all that much.
Yeah, yeah.
And the and there's a lot of girls help us spend money up there.
Yeah, yeah.
Then about, I guess it was probably about March, because it was getting warm.
Yeah.
And they assigned our ship to train midshipmen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had all these midshipmen on board.
Mm-hmm.
And that got to be a chore. You're always tripping over on these midshipmen someplace.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, young little 18-year-old guys.
Well, they weren't that much younger than... No, they weren't 18. They were probably mostly about 19, 20. About my age.
Yeah, about your age, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, at that point and stuff, were you resigned from the Navy? I mean, or...
Well, because of my age, you see, after the war, they had this point system to discharge people.
Okay.
And one was your age.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't very old.
Yeah.
And the second thing was how many children you had.
Okay.
I didn't have any children.
Didn't work for you.
Whether you had a wife or not, I didn't have a wife.
Okay.
And... Then it was how long you've been in the Navy. Well, I had been in the Navy for 3 years or so by then.
Yeah.
And, but that wasn't too much.
Yeah.
And then how much combat duty you had. I had almost none of that.
Yeah.
In the combat zone for a few minutes.
Right. It wasn't a big thing, yeah. It didn't have any points.
A couple of days, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
So I was the low man on the totem pole.
Yeah.
So we got through with the midshipmen.
Mm-hmm.
That was nice. We went to some nice places.
Yeah.
Went to Quebec and Bermuda.
Really? Wow.
And it just so happened the North Atlantic was nice and smooth.
Yeah.
And we were out there for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Halifax stopped there.
Oh, that was really nice in Halifax.
Yes, that was nice.
Let me push pause here.
Then after that, we went to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And in Philadelphia, we decommissioned the USS Montpelier.
How do you decommission a ship?
Decommission. It's just like defrocking a priest, I guess.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
But what we had to do, besides decommissioning it, we put it in mothballs.
Mothballed the ship.
Real
mothballs?
We really did. We put,
mothballs.
That's what they called it.
Yeah.
They put... that's fine. Are you got this thing on now? Yeah, well, what they do is they put this, like the styrofoam, they blow it all over everything.
Yeah.
The guns. They put,
take all the bullets out.
And they put this real heavy oil on it, and then they put this, the styrofoam stuff all over it. And,
Does that preserve them?
What?
Does that preserve them? Can you reuse them again?
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. During the Korean War, they
opened
recommissioned quite a few of those ships.
Yeah. So So what happens when they, where do they store the ship at after it's been decommissioned?
They had it right out in the river there.
Yeah.
I used to see it all the time.
Yeah.
When I was flying into Philadelphia on a commercial plane. You could look down there and there's a whole bunch of cruisers all lined up.
You can see them down there.
I could see my old ship.
Oh, really?
For years afterwards.
Oh, that'd be neat. Yeah.
And, but that took a while.
Yeah.
And we had to clean out everything and send stuff back that was valuable.
Yeah.
And I was telling Sarah, one of my jobs was to clean out the photo lab.
Really?
The camera shop and the camera thing. Of course, the cameras, you know, we had to pack them up and send them back to the wherever they went. I've forgotten now.
Yeah.
But then we had all this exposed film and photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what do we do with those? They said, throw them away.
That's history. Yeah.
And they had, I went to them and they had some really nice pictures.
So I
decided, well, maybe I better keep these.
So some of them are here.
And some of them are here now.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't keep that many of them, but, you know, I kept some.
Sure.
And, but they had all this, that kind of, you know, a lot of things, you know, that you'd like to take home, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like your pistols and rifles and things. I would mind that.
Yeah. And your Well, the one you got in Japan, though, you got to keep that one, didn't
you? Yeah, I got to keep that.
Yeah.
I lost it in a fire. My house got struck by lightning. And I still got the barrel, but the stock is a mess.
Yeah.
It burned.
Mm-hmm.
So the then, when that was done, I left good old Philadelphia.
Came back to Kentucky?
Came back to Kentucky.
Yeah. Now, were you considered out of the Navy by then or still?
Well, no. I came back and I had to go to Memphis. I came home first.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in Anchorage at the time.
Yeah.
So Dad let me borrow his old Buick and I drove down to Memphis. And I had to go to the Naval Air Station in Memphis.
Yeah.
To be discharged because that was the closest naval base to my home.
Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah. And I wasn't really discharged.
I was
put in the inactive reserve.
Okay. Yeah. Kind of decommissioned.
They decommissioned me.
Yeah.
And then I was in that was in 1946.
Okay.
The end of the summer of 46.
Yeah.
Of course, that was a lot of fun coming home there. All the guys were home, you know, and they were all spending their money.
Yeah.
And we all had our little ruptured ducks we wore.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we called them, the ruptured ducks.
That What's was a ruptured duck?
It's a little pin they gave us to say that you were a discharged veteran.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
And the, I went back to college, and after I got out of college,
was that in Kentucky when you went to college?
I went back to Illinois.
Okay.
I had two more years to finish up.
Right.
Although I had 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of the stuff I took wasn't applicable, so I had to go two more. So I ended up going to college for 5 years.
Yeah, so when did you graduate from college?
48.
Okay.
I got back and I found out that I could make a little money by going to these Navy meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back on that and going to these meetings.
Yeah.
And they pay us $60 every quarter.
Yeah.
Every 4 months.
Yeah.
In 3 months, that is.
Yeah.
And boy, I like finding money in the streets.
But you were working at that time? Or?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As an architect? Or?
Right.
Okay.
I was working for my father at that time.
Okay.
And I worked around different places. I didn't always work for him. Then I went to Lexington and worked there a while.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, then while I was working in Lexington, the Korean War started.
Yeah. And what year was that?
That was 1950.
Okay. Yeah.
And Harry Truman said we might call up a few reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, everybody in our outfit got their orders.
Wow, might call up a few, huh? Okay.
And so I got orders to, at first I'd go through a physical and everything, got orders to to the USS Helena, okay. Which is another cruiser.
Yeah.
Now, my first ship was a light cruiser,
uh-huh.
And Helena was a heavy cruiser.
Okay.
But they're almost the same size. They're
okay.
Only the real only difference was the main battery size.
Okay.
And if I gave you a picture of both of them, you could probably couldn't tell them apart.
Really? Okay.
And inside, they were pretty much arranged the same too. So I was right at home.
Yeah.
And
you felt pretty comfortable.
On the yeah.
Ship. Yeah.
And of course, my experiences on the Helena. I wrote this book on
about.
It, this one right here.
Right.
And
why did you call the Forgotten Ship and the Forgotten War? Mm-hmm. How did that name come around?
Well, that's just what it was.
Yeah.
I wrote that book, and of course, I tried to get it published.
Now, when did you write the book? How long after your experience?
I wrote it when I was about 75 years
okay.
old, and let's see, I'm about 84 now, 83.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah.
But nobody wanted to publish the book,
mm.
and all the authors said, I got the same story. They
yeah.
said, "Oh, it's a nice book." I said,
yeah.
"Said, but we can't publish a book about Korea. They don't sell."
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And I even gave it to UK Press, and I got a very nice report on it from from my friend Sherry, who was the director at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He said, like the book. He said, hey, that's might be your best book. But he said, they won't sell.
Wow.
And I tried several other people and read, published Navy books and things.
Yeah, wasn't going.
Won't sell. And so I finally published myself, thought I could sell enough to probably break even with by some to my shipmates.
Yeah, and so many of them bought them?
Well, quite a few did, yes, but I overestimated the number would buy them.
Yeah, yeah.
See, we had about 1,300 sailors on board
mm-hmm.
at any one time, and they were coming and going. So,
right.
At the time I was on board, I mm-hmm. probably there were probably 1,500 or 1,600
mm-hmm.
plus the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I'll be able to sell 1,000 books or so, but I think I probably would sell 750.
Yes, yeah.
And which what I didn't take into consideration is I guess a lot of them are dead.
Passed out, yeah. Yeah, their families might be interested, but I don't know. So what happened when you got back on the boat then, back on the Helena?
Oh, well, that was kind of a nice ship.
Mm-hmm.
First time I was on the cruiser, I was the lowest officer in the whole ship. Everybody outranked me.
Yeah.
But this time, I was a Lieutenant JG, so I wasn't very high on the pecking
What's
order.
What's JG there. Stand for?
Junior grade.
Okay.
Lieutenant junior grade.
Okay.
And but that's still better than being an ensign.
Sure.
So instead of sitting at the last table, I sat at the next to the last table.
Well, it's a move up.
Yes.
Yeah.
So your rooms and your place where you sit is mm-hmm. always.
Yes, the pecking order there.
There's always this pecking order. You go by your file number.
Yeah.
Everybody has a file number. Mine was 451-880. And anybody was 451-882 would sit below me.
Okay.
I would rank them, you see.
Yeah. Was Larry Moore on that tour with you?
No. Larry never got called up. He was I think he was an attorney. He was living in Latrobe, and he became the attorney for the famous golfer from Latrobe. I don't know what's his name. But you know the fellow I'm talking about, the golfer from Latrobe. It was number one golfer in the country for a long time.
I'm not sure who that might have been. I'm not a big golf person. So so you were on the Helena.
Palmer.
Yeah.
Palmer.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of Palmer.
Yeah, he was Palmer's attorney.
Well, that's a pretty good thing to be attorney of.
Plus maybe some other people too, but
yeah.
I knew to take care of Palmer.
Yeah. So where'd you sign on to the Helena? Where'd you board the Helena for
well,
the next tour?
Well, I had orders, and I got the thing about this when you're in the Navy, they usually furnish your transportation when you're on order. And if you're on leave, you got to furnish your own.
Right.
But I had a ticket, went from Louisville to Chicago, and from Chicago to San Francisco.
Okay.
And
You made that train trip before.
Yeah, no, that this is airplane.
This airplane.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're in a new age here.
We're a new age. Off a plane.
New age, yeah, I'm on DC-4.
Yeah.
And then we got to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We got some more shots. And in a very short order, they put a bunch of us on the biggest flying boat there was. It mm-hmm. was called the Mars.
The Mars, huh?
The Mars. I have a picture of it in there. Hmm. And it was the biggest flying boat in the in operation at the time. It was huge. Hmm. Had two decks on it.
Wow.
You know, upper deck and a lower deck. Hmm. And they flew us out to Hawaii on mm-hmm. the Mars.
Yeah.
And then from Hawaii, they put us on a match plane. Mm-hmm. And it was a Marine match plane. And then we went the same way we'd gone on with the old CVE-1. We stopped at Kwajalein.
Same places, yeah.
And Aniwetok. But we got to Guam. Mm-hmm. We stopped there because the weather was bad. The pilot said, okay. So, mm-hmm. said, you guys can quit here because we're going to wait for the weather to clear out.
Sure.
So we got on these planes, the only thing they give you is a little box with a piece of stale bread and a piece of cheese sandwich on stale bread and an orange.
Yeah.
That's all you get. So we got there, and they kicked us out, and we were very happy to get out because we could go to the officer's club and have steak and eggs.
Yeah. But much better grub there.
Much better. So we stayed there a day, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the weather cleared out, so then we went back up to the airport. Mm-hmm. And that was a horrible little base. They were all Quonset huts, old metal Quonset huts.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah.
And I didn't think too much of Guam.
Yeah.
But they flew us up to Japan, and we landed up near Yokohama. Mm-hmm. And I got a bus, or they put us on a bus or something, took us over to Yokosuka, which was the fancy Navy base out there on the on the edge of Tokyo Bay. Mm-hmm. And, it was a sweet place to be. Yeah,
that's in Japan then?
Oh, man.
How were the Japanese then? Did you get to interact very much with the Japanese at that point?
The Japanese were all, we were in Japan, of course.
Yeah. So.
But that Navy base, you never saw anything like it. I went up to dinner, and man, they have silver plates and silverware out and all this sort of stuff. And
it's a government issue.
But every place had one good looking Japanese girl that took care of that one person.
Jeepers.
Jeepers. So boy, this is a place for me. I'd like to be here.
Yeah.
But I didn't stay there but one day. Oh. And they took me down, put me on a train again. Mm-hmm. There's three of us. And one fellow was going to the Rochester, and I was going to, and two of us were going to the Helena. Mm-hmm. And one guy was a fellow named Hershey or Hurley, Hurley, anyhow. And he was from New Jersey, and he talked real Brooklyn-ish. Brooklyn-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never could figure out what he was saying. Mm-hmm. But we got down there just in time to see the old Helena take off out for the
takeoff.
We went to Sasebo on a train. Tokyo is up one end, the northern end, and Sasebo is the farthest end south. Mm-hmm. And Sasebo is right across from Korea.
Okay.
Just a short distance. Mm. And so it went on out. And
you weren't on it?
I wasn't on it, no. So we checked in with the operations, and they said, don't worry about it. So we're going to put you on the brush. And this was a destroyer, so they put us on this destroyer the next day and sent us out to the the destroyer's going to take us to the Helena.
Okay. Hitching a ride. Okay.
And we got out there, and they had these junks. They were supplying the Korean army with these junks.
Yeah.
And these junks were behind this little island. Mm. And the Helena couldn't get back there, and it was shelling over there.
Oh,
wow. So this little destroyer I was on, there again, I'm in transit. I don't have a job. I'm just sitting around loafing.
You're pretty lucked out with that.
And so I got up on the, up behind the bridge. There was a deck back there, right by some guns. As a matter of fact, I took a bunch of pictures, and they went back in behind this island and started shooting up these sampans, and got in a little firefight. Mm. And here's a picture I took from the brush. You can see I was at a pretty good spot there.
Yeah.
Got to see everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And so they were blasting these little sampans, and they got a machine gun up on a hill, and they started shooting at us.
Hmm.
And so we stayed back there until we sank those sampans.
Hmm.
And then they took us on out. And then there's another picture here. Mm-hmm. They took us over on the breacher's buoy. There's my friend from New Jersey coming over. I took that after I got on the ship.
Yeah.
And it's about 40 yards across between the ships, you know, and they have that little device rigged up called a breacher's buoy.
Ew.
And
was that a ride?
And as you ride across on that little breacher's buoy.
Were they still shooting at you?
No, not then. We were back out now. Out in the ocean. Once we got a mile or two away from shore, we didn't have to worry about anybody shooting at us except the airplane.
That was kind of scary. So then, after you got back on your ship,
back on a cruiser again.
Yeah.
And this time, instead of being back in the junior officer's bunk room, for some reason, they didn't want to move everybody around us to take care of rooms. They put me in the room with our helicopter pilot. Hmm. He was the lieutenant.
Hmm. And what was your grade at that point in the Navy?
I was a JG.
JGs, okay.
And he was a full lieutenant. Okay. But he was a department head.
Okay.
Because he was the only aviator on board.
That's pretty good.
So he was the head of the aviation department. Mm-hmm. He was the only flyer on board. And he had some enlisted man that took care of the helicopter.
Yeah.
Some mechanics and things. Mm-hmm. But he was a department head, so he deserved a room up in the forward part of the. So I was bunked up right next to the executive officer.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And they had their own fancy John up there, but I was too. I decided I knew my place. I didn't go there. I went back to the other John.
Yeah, yeah. Discretion there.
Yeah. Where all the junior officers were.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be in there with all those three stripers, you know.
Yeah.
But they really didn't have a job for me, so they made me the assistant gunnery officer.
Okay.
Which it sounded pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to stand all the usual watches, you know. Mm-hmm. I had to watch in the director and then CIC. And the gunnery officer would give me things to do.
Yeah. Did you have much action going on in terms of?
But I didn't have any enlisted men under me then.
Okay.
Because I was assistant gunnery officer.
Yeah.
And we had plenty of action because that's all we did. We just had shore bombardments all the time.
Yeah.
And I tell about one that was kind of interesting in the book here. When we first got there, you know, the Americans were all back in what they called the Pusan Peninsula perimeter, the Pusan perimeter. And they were all jammed up in there in the bottom of Korea and holding on for the dear life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were on interdiction fire one night. And interdiction fire, what we do, they'd have an area in Korea, and the gunnery officer would come down, he'd have a big map, and he'd say, here's what we're going to shoot at tonight. We're going to shoot here and here.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd give us these targets.
Yeah.
And he said, this target, 3 rounds an hour, and this target, 1 round an hour, and this target, 2 rounds an hour. And he'd give us a schedule like that. And what we were supposed to do was to fire these things without any kind of rhyme or reason. You didn't want them to get to know when we were going to shoot.
The pattern of it,
We don't want to establish any patterns. So some bright junior officer figured out that if we played gin rummy, we'd sign cards to these things, these targets.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And we'd be planning a shack of spades would come up, and that would be this target over here. So we'd got to fire one there.
That's a pretty good way to do it.
And so we were doing that for a while.
Gin rummy bombing.
And it's called interdiction fire. And one night, they always had me on the machine, on the drafting machine there. Give the bearing and the range, and I fouled up a little bit. I got mixed up, and lo and behold, we hit an ammunition dump.
And
they called down, they said, come on out the deck and look at this. It looks like 4th of July out here. And all this, but we all ran out and looked, and all this stuff was exploding all over the place.
So
it did look like
4th
of July.
You didn't intend to do that, but.
No, and we came back to see what target was, and we realized that we'd transposed the range with the bearing, and we knew it was going to happen. We knew the captain and the gunnery officer were going to come down and find out what target it was.
Yeah.
And we had to admit it wasn't any of the targets that we were given.
Yeah, it was an accident.
It was an accident. The target was someplace over here where we weren't supposed to be firing at all.
Yeah.
And we didn't get any medals, but we didn't get court-martialed, so I guess it was all right.
Even trade there.
Yeah. So that's what we did there for that all during the whole period.
Yeah. How long were you there then?
Well, what we would do, we'd go out for about 30 days, and then we'd run out of ammunition, so we'd go back to Sasebo.
Right.
And then we'd all party and get drunk and have a good time. And
reload up.
And they'd give us more ammunition, some more food, and so forth. And then we'd go back again for another 30 days, and that was our schedule. And most of the time we were on shore bombardment, but on occasion we would escort carriers. They had two carriers out there.
Which were the carriers out there?
Well, the Princeton was one of them, and what was the other one? Carl C. maybe.
Okay.
But of course the carriers always had a lot of ships around them, with them. And so sometimes we'd have that duty, and sometimes we'd have the duty of shore bombardment. And we stayed out there, and when the invasion of Incheon came, we weren't in on that. Our ship was. Instead, they had this the Missouri came out there, and they put a bunch of newsreel people on board our ship.
We thought,
newsreel guys. Okay,
stars.
So we went in and we did old shore bombardment. Aren't you going to take a picture? No, we're not going to take a picture. Hmm. Said, what are you going to take a picture of? I said, we're waiting for the Missouri to get here.
Oh, okay.
But the Missouri was stuck in the mud, believe it or not. It ran aground.
Oh, no.
It was stuck in the mud. And it finally got up in North Korea. And so then all those guys were really happy because we got to take some pictures of Missouri,
bombarding.
And it made us sick because, next week was on the cover of Time magazine and Newsweek and everything. They all had a big picture. Missouri wins the war. They were out there one day, and we'd been out there two months.
Not fair.
But at the same time, they had another operation that was really fouled up. Nobody heard about it, but they had a bunch of Koreans, and they had a Korean LST. And this fellow was supposed to take the Koreans in behind the Pusan lines, right where in the critical time when we were invading over in Incheon and doing pretty good. They were supposed to go over there, and this a bunch of Koreans that were on this LST were supposed to get behind the lines, and cause trouble.
Yeah.
Well, instead of going towards Busan, they headed the wrong direction.
Uh-oh.
There was a town north of there, and they decided they'd go there first. Maybe they had some girlfriends or something up there. I don't know. But that town was just full of North Koreans, and so they were outnumbered, and they had a little battle, and they ran these Koreans back to the LST. And there were a bunch of them there. But this Korean had landed right, and he got the doggone thing stuck, and he couldn't get it off.
Oh.
You're supposed to be able to pull those things off with an anchor, But he was and I think he punched a hole in the bottom, too. But anyhow, he was in bad shape. So they sent and got another LST, and this all took like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah,
and tried to get them off, and most of them they got off, but some of them wouldn't come. They didn't like; they were afraid of water.
Yeah,
and they just wouldn't come out and wade out to the LST.
Yeah,
but all that time, while we had to hold off these Koreans.
Yeah,
with the ship's guns, so they wouldn't kill these other South Koreans.
Yeah,
and so that's what we were doing when they were invading Incheon over there.
Yeah. That was your job.
That was our job, and we weren't even supposed to be there in the first place. It's supposed to, supposedly it would never have happened, you know. They let them go and pulled out and gone.
But it didn't work out that way.
Didn't work out that way, yeah.
Yeah. So you were able to save quite a bit of them, though, quite a few of them?
Yeah, quite a few of them.
Yeah.
But the, so then, after that, a short time after that, they did break out of the Fusan Peninsula. They had a breakout there, and they start up the coast, and we'd help them when they try to put roadblocks up and things. We'd come over and help them out.
Yeah.
And they finally got up to Wonsan, and everybody thought, well, the war's going to be over now, because that's what MacArthur was telling us. He wasn't telling us about all those Chinese that were up there.
Yeah.
He kind of kept that to himself. So the Navy decided that they'd send us back to get some new guns. So we headed back to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And about the time we got back there, the Chinese got in the war.
Mm. What year was that then?
That was at the end of 1950 and beginning of 1951.
Okay.
I've got the dates and things in the book.
Yeah.
But the... But we were back in Frisco, and everybody got to go home and so forth. That was.
So you got to go to Louisville?
As a matter of fact, I did. Because when you're on leave, the officers don't get paid to go on leave. You know, you leave the ship and you're on leave, but you have to pay for your own transportation.
Yeah.
So this one ensign and I, we got on the bus and went down to Moffett Airfield. He said, "Hey, you got any airplanes going to?" Going anywhere? And he said, "Yeah, we got one leaving in 10 minutes for Corpus Christi."
Yeah, Texas.
We said, "Oh boy, we'll take that." And we got on that thing. We went to Corpus Christi. It flew all night to get there.
Yeah,
those planes weren't all that fast in those days.
Yeah.
And next morning, we slept a little bit and got a BOQ and slept a little bit and went down to the office. Said, "Okay, we got any planes going to Memphis today?"
Yeah.
"Nope, sorry," said the. "We're not flying any planes. It's almost Christmas," and said, "We're closing down till after Christmas." And we said, "Oh well." So we took the Greyhound up to Houston and then got an Eastern to Louisville.
Yeah.
My friend went to Chicago.
Yeah.
And so I got home for.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I didn't have an apartment anymore. I'd already
given that up. Yeah.
So I stayed in my father's house and.
Yeah.
And I had an MG, it was an MGTG.
Oh boy!
And so I decided I'd drive that out because we were going to be in San Francisco for at least a couple of months while they're fixing up the ship.
See,
we had to get new guns because we wore the guns out
with
all that firing we did. And
you drove cross country.
So I decided I'd drive back. It's a pretty long drive.
It's a long drive.
And. And the MG doesn't have a heater.
Oh, dear. In December. Okay.
So I decided, well, the best way is to take Highway 80. That way you were down south,
Right.
Go through El Paso and
it's warmer
Tucson.
Down that
way. But I'll tell you, when going through that West Texas, it got pretty doggone cold.
Yeah. And it's flat, too. It's miles and miles.
But I made it back all right. Got to San Diego for New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Went to Tijuana.
Yeah.
And with some officers I met there at the officers club, we said, "Well, we go to Tijuana."
Yeah.
Went down there and they used to steal hubcaps there, but they couldn't steal hubcap off an MG, so they took the radiator cap. Oh, well, that's the way it goes.
So you got the car back up to
I put a cork in it. I got a big cork and stuck it in there. Drove up to San Francisco with the cork in the
in the car. That's an adventure.
But we had a pretty nice layover there, and then we went to Long Beach for a while.
Yeah.
After they finished up at San Francisco, they sent us down to Long Beach, and we were docked in it. We had a dock there, which was right next to the old sailing ship that they used in Mutiny on the Bounty with Clark Gable. I don't know if you ever saw that old movie.
I've heard of it, yeah.
It was an old, big old sailing ship, and they'd made the sailing ship just for that movie.
Wow.
And it was sort of impressive.
So how long were you in Long Beach there then?
Oh, well, we were in and out because we had to do shakedown cruise. Mm-hmm. They had to do a shakedown cruise.
Right.
So, but we were probably there a month or so.
Yeah.
And about half the guys left the ship, mm-hmm. And got new officers, new men, and so mm-hmm. forth. And we went back to Korea again.
Really? Now, that was 51 then?
This was 51, right. Yeah. And by this time, they had switched me over to operations office, mm-hmm. and made me a coding officer.
Hmm.
And so my job was to set up these codes and type out things in code and break these codes and do
yeah.
that sort of stuff.
Hmm.
And it was a tough, tough, tough job because mm-hmm. the admiral wanted, had an admiral on board, mm-hmm. and he wanted everything broken. Even stuff that didn't mean anything to us. He wanted
yeah.
it broken anyhow.
Hmm.
And so he kept us really busy.
Hmm.
And my GQ station, as I always told everybody, was in Conaft. And, mm-hmm. and if you could stand the diesel fumes, that's mm-hmm. the best GQ station on the whole ship.
Hmm.
Because, see, these Navy ships, they have a backup for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if the bridge was blown away, mm-hmm. where the captain and,
right.
and the admirals and so forth run
mm-hmm.
the ship, if they,
yeah.
they'd wipe that part of the ship out,
mm-hmm.
then the guys in Conaft would run the ship.
Wow.
We're way in the back.
Okay.
And nobody ever came up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little steel house we could get into if we wanted to.
Yeah.
And with radar and all this stuff mm-hmm. in it, and had all the communications. And we had a little deck out there where we'd
yeah.
go when it was sunny.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah,
a nice,
not a bad
just
place.
A nice place. And
yeah.
No, and we didn't have to do anything. And yeah, nobody ever came up there.
Well, that's good. And did y'all have air conditioning on the boat? Or?
Oh, no.
No. Okay.
No.
It was hot.
Except when it got cooler, we had air conditioning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was my GQ station during the almost the whole time I was on ship.
Yeah. Now, where did you all travel from 51? Where all were you in Korea, different places?
The Korea, we were all up and down the coast of Korea, but we never
yeah.
stayed any place very long.
Right.
We were on a ship. We were
mm-hmm.
just moving all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We would go to port in either Yokosuka or Sasebo.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Yokosuka gave us better opportunities to go places because we could get a train and go into Tokyo.
Yeah.
Or we could take a bus or something, get into, or train boat and mm-hmm. get into Yokohama.
Yeah.
And that was a nice place to go
yeah.
to.
Hmm.
One time, there were three of us, and we decided we were in Tokyo, and we decided we'd take a cab back to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And this cab driver got lost 15 times. He'd never been out of Tokyo, I don't think.
Y'all had help.
Cost us 3,000 yen to get back
oh
to
heavens.
Our ship.
Oh, my heavens.
Which was a big money in those
yeah,
days.
Yeah, a lot of money. So did you bring back any memorabilia from your time there?
Oh, well, I brought back all kinds of things, sure.
Yeah.
I brought most of the stuff I got at the PX,
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't, I
yeah.
didn't have anything special. But,
yeah, from Korea.
But I got a bunch of Japanese prints,
yeah,
and which were pretty nice, you know,
yeah.
and some other things.
Yeah.
But then anyhow, so I stayed on the ship
mm-hmm.
until about July, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and then I got transferred over to. I was on the staff, an admiral staff,
mm-hmm.
and they made me communications officer on Task Force 77.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, I was a flag bird.
A flag bird.
A flag bird.
Flag.
And I hated flag birds.
Oh,
all
really?
My life, I'd hated flag birds.
Because
they never did anything. They just stood around and, you know, they were with the admiral.
Yeah. Kind
and they
of boring.
Weren't. They weren't real guys. They weren't real
yeah.
ship's guys. They
yeah.
were flag birds.
Yeah.
But here I was one of them. All of a sudden.
Oh boy.
And so I was on a bunch of ships while I was a flag bird. Because I'd go.
Admiral moved around.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the admiral had this great idea that, see, we were supposed to get income tax deductions,
mm-hmm.
and if we were in combat zone. So being a flag bird, we didn't have to be in the combat zone. But the admiral thought it would be really nice if we got on the ship and went over to Korea. The last 2 days of the month, that's 2 days gives you the combat.
Oh, okay.
You get the exemption
him
2 days.
Too, huh?
Then we say the next 2 days of the next month.
Yeah.
So we stay 4 days in the combat zone, and we get 2 months exemption.
Yeah.
If we timed it right.
Yeah. That was pretty smart of him.
Yeah, so that's what we did. And so I was on there for a while, and then I got orders to come home. All of us reserve officers that spent a year over there,
yeah,
they let us opt to come home if we wanted to after a year.
Yeah.
So, of course, by the time I heard about it, I was already over a year, but anyhow. I took them up on it.
Yeah.
And I rode back on up to Yokosuka, get a ride home somehow.
Yeah.
And I ran into some of my buddies up there. And so naturally, I got drunk a couple of times and missed the ship.
Oh, dear.
And I think I missed two ships.
Oh, dear.
But I was having a good time in Tokyo and everything. Yeah. And so one morning, I was sleeping on the Toledo. That's another cruiser. That's where I'd ridden up on the Toledo, and they said I could stay there. I instead of going to the BOQ, I just stayed on the Toledo.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be there a while.
Yeah.
And so one morning, I was sleeping in Toledo, and all of a sudden, here comes the sailor, and he wakes me up. You Mr. Hammond? Yeah. I said, well, the commander came over to get me. He wanted me to get you and take you to his office. And I said, well, okay. So I got up, started getting dressed and everything. And he said, he wants me to bring your bags and your luggage. And I said, oh, okay. So he told me to pack them. I said, all right, there they are right there.
Yeah.
So anyhow, they must have thought I was really some hotshot on the Toledo bed. Here comes this sailor carrying all my bags down the gangplank, you know.
Yeah.
Into the Jeep. I get in there and he drives away with it, you know. So I got over to the office, and this commander, he was a little bit unhappy with my conduct because I'd missed so many ships.
Yeah.
So he said, Mr. Hammond, he said, I'm sending you, the sailor's going to take you up to the airport, and I told him to stay there until your plane took off. He said, I got a plane for you.
Get you out of here.
So I went up to the airport, got on the plane, and took off. And all these guys had been in the office there, you know. They said, my wife's having a baby. Please get me home on the first ship and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I got home 3 weeks before any of those guys.
Yeah, yeah. You made it, huh? Just because of that, huh?
So that was about the end of my Navy career. I landed in San Francisco. Almost didn't make it, though. The last landing in San Francisco, that was really tough.
Yeah.
We came in there, and I'm a passenger on this plane. I was the only passenger on this particular cargo plane. And it was like a DC-3, only it was military, you know. It had benches on the side, didn't have any seats in it.
Right.
And we came in there, and it was early in the morning. We hit the coast of San Francisco. It's at San Francisco. And I looked out. I'm up sitting up there with the pilots, you know. Looked out, and here's this fog. This whole valley is completely full of top fog all the way up the top of the mountains. It's kind of foaming over the mountains a little bit.
Yeah.
And I looked down there, and the Moffett Field's right down in between two mountains.
Yeah.
In this fog. And it was from the top of the mountains down to the ground. It was solid fog. And I said, why don't we head down to Los Angeles? Maybe the weather will be a little better down that way.
Yeah.
He said, can't do it. He said, I'm out of gas.
Yeah,
gotta
land. Yeah.
I said, I gotta land. I said, oh, no. I was a pilot myself.
Did you?
In a small plane,
Yeah,
I had a pilot's license. But I knew what he was in for. So he had a precision radar approach. The first one he missed. Shoved the throttle to the wall and took out again. We went up on the top and got all set up again, and the second one, he was really out of gas.
Oh,
he said, "We're going to land this time." I said, "Yeah, I guess we are." And he came down. We couldn't see anything. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Oh.
And this time, boy, he pulled those throttles back and pulled a stick back and held it back. We hit the runway and came in, and I'm still here. So.
Yeah, it must have meant to be.
So that was about the, that's about the story of my naval career.
Yeah. So you weren't in any engagements where you felt like your life, limb were threatened immediately, or?
Well, they shot at us, back at us a few times. But, but half the time when, you know, after they put me in communications, I don't remember them ever shooting at me while I was on GQ and up on deck.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in the coding room, that's on the bottom of the ship. I couldn't tell what was going on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They could have shot they could have shot both funnels off, and I wouldn't have known
it. You still keep up with some of your fellow people from the ship and get together any?
There's just one or two.
Yeah.
Most of them. My good friend, my buddy Brownie Baker, who was a Marine officer. My friend during the Korean War, well, he died.
Yeah,
he was the cousin of the Baker who was the Secretary of State, which is, and but his wife married another officer who was on the ship.
Yeah,
his name was Edward Horton.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of Edward Horton?
I don't think so.
Well, he was the big movie star back in the 30s and early 40s.
Okay.
He played the butler a lot.
Okay.
And that was his uncle.
Wow.
And he was one of the Yaleys.
Yeah.
And when I got on the Helena, about all these ensigns were ROTC guys from Yale.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these all these Yale guys, they thought they were smarter than everybody
Kentucky
else.
Kentucky guys especially.
And they might have been. I don't know.
Yeah.
They were all pretty good Joes. Well, I got along fine with them.
Yeah.
But Horton then married Ann Baker, and I still see them once in a while.
That's good.
I hear from them now.
That's good.
Of course, they live down in Texas.
Yeah.
But
have you been up to D.C. and isn't there a Korean memorial now up there?
I don't know.
I'm thinking there was.
I haven't been to D.C. quite a while. I used to go up there on business down then.
Yeah.
But and then I had my father-in-law lived up there, and I was up there a lot when he died. But I haven't been there lately.
So I guess you got married after the war, huh?
After the Korean War.
Yeah.
I got married.
Yeah. So children?
And my wife was an Army brat.
Oh, really?
Yes. Huh. Her father was a colonel in the Army. And she'd gone to UK.
Yeah.
There were 2 years, and then her father was the attaché in the Netherlands. So her father took her over there.
She traveled
She spent a couple of years over in the Netherlands, and she got back here, and her daddy told her that if she was going to school, she had to go do something practical.
Yeah.
And so she went to U of L, and she was in some class she didn't like. And when I proposed to her, she quit college the next day.
Had enough of that, huh? Yeah. So did you all have children?
Yeah, we have two. We had two boys.
Yeah. Do you share with them some of your stories, or were they
interested? Well, they could read it in my book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, my children used all my. They wore all my uniforms when they're growing up.
Did they?
Yeah. Oh. Every time I turn around, they were dressing up in them.
Can you still get in them? Or?
No, no way.
A little different size and shape.
Yes, I'm a lot wider around the middle here than I was
then.
Had
to be a little trimmer and fitter in the Navy,
That's
guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
I still got my Navy uniform, my whites.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one I've got.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, the whites were the most comfortable uniform we had.
Really?
Because you didn't have to wear a tie. And you know, you wore the coat, and they had the Nehru collar on it.
Right.
What they call them now, I guess.
Yeah.
And that was very comfortable. And you didn't wear a shirt under them.
Yeah.
So they're cool.
Yeah.
And they were made out of cotton, so they, you know,
breathe,
they could breathe.
Yeah. What were the other uniforms made of?
Oh, well, they were different ones. They were made out of blue, which was made out of wool.
Oh, that's hot.
And, of course, those are winter uniforms.
Yeah.
and the Browns, this uniform, which is gabardine.
Yeah.
They weren't too bad.
Yeah, but you had to wear a tie with those.
Yeah, I had to wear a tie, shirt and tie.
Yeah.
And but so the whites were really the most comfortable we had.
Yeah.
And our hats, you know, the top part of the hats, we changed those.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a white uniform, you take this brown one off, put a white one on.
Okay, well, that made it easier.
Or a blue one if you had a blue.
Yeah.
And the and then for work uniforms, we just wore a plain old pants and khaki pants and shirt and tan.
Yeah.
And. And, you know, in the Philippines, it was so nasty out there. It would rain all the time, you know, and everything rotted.
Yeah.
And I was living in this tent.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow my shoes gave out.
Mm-hmm.
And the soles fell off of them.
Oh, no.
And they didn't have any kind of a PX or any place to buy any clothing there.
Really?
In this little place where we were stationed. And so the town of Tacloban was across this little bay from us, and so I got a boat to take me over there, and went over to the Army PX and got a pair of Army shoes.
There you go.
That was the best I could do.
Yeah, well,
get a pair of Army shoes.
Yeah.
Everybody's kidding me about my Army shoes, but I mean, it was either that or go barefooted.
Nothing. Yeah. Did you get any medals or recommendations or anything like that?
Well, our ship, both ships, got a presidential citation.
Mm-hmm.
The second ship, the Helena, the president wasn't us. It was Syngman Rhee, who was the president of Korea, gave us one.
Hmm.
And I didn't know it when I was in the Navy, that either one, we had the presidential citation. I learned that 30 years later.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I'm not wearing those, as you can see.
Yeah, yeah. That was a little early yet. Yeah. Well, I was interested in some of your songs here. You have to sing a few.
You want me to sing some of the songs?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Well,
you got the words here. I don't think I'll sing some of those with you.
All right. You want to sing some of them with me?
No, I don't think I will, but I'll let you sing them.
Well, the first one, the cruiser song here. Uh-huh. This one they're singing in the South Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you all sang that together?
What? Oh yeah, we get together and get a bunch of beer.
So that's your entertainment.
Get all boozed up and sing songs.
Make up the words to it.
And somebody made up the words. I don't know who made them up.
Mm-hmm.
And the you want me to really sing this song?
Sure, it's history, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Oh, the captain has a squeaky voice. Hasn't it by his own choice? He lost his balls in a powder hoist in the armored cruiser squadron. Away, away with sword and gun. Here we come, full of rum, looking for someone to put on the bum in the armored cruiser squadron. That's the chorus. You sing that with all the choruses.
So. Right.
Oh, the executive officer rants and raves, never bathes, never shaves. His only hope is Jesus saves in the armored cruiser squadron. The engineer is a standing joke. It's 7 knots long we poke and fill the ocean full of smoke in the armored cruiser squadron. The navigator's a silly tar. He shoots the truck light for a star and never knows just where we are in the armored cruiser squadron. The gunnery officer's the real big snot who fills the 8-inch with buckshot and puts some duck meat in the pot in the armored cruiser squadron. The officers are a bunch of drunks. They stand their watches in their bunks. Their uniform is bathing trunks in the armored cruiser squadron. Of course, that's much longer if you put the chorus by
sure,
there,
every time,
you
yeah.
know, and have a beer in between.
Of course, you gotta have a drink of beer between them. And
And you want the next one?
Sure, I may get that on mine here. Hold on, let me get my.
Now this is the real South Pacific classic here. Okay. I mean to tell you, they all sang this one.
All right.
I'm not sure I have the best voice in the world for it, but I'll try. Oh, the princess papaya has plenty papui. She loves to give it away. And all the neighbors, they say, oh, Mia, oh, Maya, you really ought to try a little piece of the princess papaya's papui. She loves to give it away. And that's it.
Okay. And what's that last one there?
Oh, this one. Now, this one's the also a very old, very well-used song.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the monkeys have no tails in Zambarango. Yes, the monkeys have no tails in Zambarango. I said, the monkeys have no tails. They were bitten off by whales. Oh, the monkeys have no tails in Zambarango. Oh, the birdies have no feet in Merivale's. Yes, the birdies have no feet in Merivale's. I said, the birdies have no feet. They were burned off by the heat. Oh, the birdies have no feet in Merivale's. There's a virgin on the Isle of Cebu. There's a virgin on the Isle of Cebu. There's a virgin, so they say. She'll be 6 weeks old today. There's a virgin on the Isle of Cebu. Now, this last one, is your, this last one's got the same tune as Indiana.
Okay. I'm getting my, I'm putting them on three different ones, so. Okay.
All right.
This is supposed to be by the tune of Indiana, if I'm on tune. Oh, take me back to new construction. It's the place I long to be. I want to be the heel who lays the keel of a ship that won't be ready until 1963. I've seen it all. I've been in Sydney. I don't want a Hawaiian lay. I've been banging ears for years and years for one thing, to get back to that good old USA. That's about it.
That's
this
cool.
One isn't any good. Yeah.
Which one is that one?
Huh? Well, sorry, this one. I don't even remember the
tune to it.
I don't even remember the tune.
Yeah, those are pretty good. Sounds like you had some fun there.
Huh?
Some fun times.
Well, actually, I didn't have too bad a time in the Navy. As things went.
Yeah.
And at the age that I was, I sort of enjoyed much of
it. Adventure. It was an adventure.
There were parts of it that were rather, what would be the word? Boring almost.
Mm-hmm. Tedious. And
more than that, where everybody's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't they do the right thing instead of doing all these stupid things, you know?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, frustrating.
Frustrating. That's the word, frustrating.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's pretty frustrating.
Yeah. Did you lose any friends that were close to you during that time?
Well, you know, when I first started out, when I was in the V-12, I was a Sigma Chi in college, and I went up to Purdue. That's where I had to check in.
Yeah.
And I ran into these two Sigma Chi's that were going in at the same time. And I ran into this guy, Lyman Vogt, who I went to high school with. And his daddy was a Vogt machinery. They made fire plugs and things in Louisville, and I'd gone to high school with him. And he was there, and he had pledged Sigma Chi.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the four of us living in, we four of us managed to get a room together. And we, in our four-man room, we were all Sigma Chi's, and three of the four I stayed in contact with while they were alive. Lyman Vogt used to live right next door to my father. Matter of fact, he bought a house that my father lived in.
Yeah.
And my father built a house next door.
Cool.
So, yes, some of them I, you know, kept in contact with.
Yeah.
And Brownie Baker and I, they used to stop and see us while he was alive all the time. I don't see Hart and Dirt too much, but they call up once in a while and send Christmas cards and things. And another fellow that I is still alive, I hear from him once in a while, but I've never seen him since I got off the Montpelier, was a fellow named Cataldo, and he, Larry Moore and I and Cataldo were in the same room and on the Montpelier for a long time.
Yeah.
And he was an Italian fellow from Boston. And he kept telling us that when he got out, he was putting us on, of course.
Yeah.
When he got out of the Navy, he was going to work for Mayor Curley. Have you ever heard of Mayor Curley? Well, he'd been mayor for years and years.
Oh, mayor, okay.
Yeah, he was mayor when he was in jail one time. He'd ran a very corrupt system there, but he was really putting us on because he didn't go to work for Mayor Curley, although that's what he kept saying he was going to do.
Yeah.
And everyone saw, he's living in Florida now. hear from him now, very, very, very occasionally.
Yeah.
And so.
So you want your children and your grandchildren to know a little bit more. Of course, you have your book that they can read.
Yeah, right. Well, actually, my book's got a lot more in it than I can talk
did
about.
It, yeah. Well, we appreciate you sharing that and everything.
And so you can have these two.
Well, thanks. And those will be at part of the Kentucky Historical Society.
Keep the book.
And then all the other pictures that you've donated in the past.
Right, if you can find them. You know, I asked for if they were there, and they said they hadn't sorted them out yet the last time I was there.
Well, you know.
Last time I asked, but that was a couple of years ago, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So what in your Navy career do you think helped you in terms of your living your life since then?
Oh, well, actually, I think it was all a very good experience. I think I'm a better person because of it.
Yeah.
I don't think it changed me much or any.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm the same same guy I was before.
Yeah. I guess you couldn't use your gunnery skills in architecture.
I don't know. I had to go duck hunting once in a while.
And all. How about your communication skills? I mean,
I never, of course, never used those.
Yeah, so. Dot, dot, dash.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we had the funny thing is, with when I was in communications, I quickly learned all our radio men were Mexican Americans from Los Angeles, they were the happiest. That was the happiest crew I ever saw. Man, they were always joking around and smiling and laughing and everything.
Well, that's good.
I guess they could say anything they wanted to about the officers because none of us could speak Spanish.
I bet you picked up a few words, though.
But they were very good at their job, I'll tell you. And this was before they used to have the recorders. We had recorders, but not the kind they have now that they use on communications.
Yeah. Were there many African Americans or any other the races mixed in on the boats? Or
we had everything on. When I was on the Montpelier, I had one black man in our company, the company that I was in charge of. I was a junior officer in this company, and he was a really good sailor when he was out at sea. We had a little problem with some lot. He was not the only one. Some of the white ones were the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They were fine when they're at sea, and they couldn't get in any trouble.
Yeah.
But when he got ashore, he kept getting in trouble. I remember one time he stole a top coat in a bar someplace in New York City, and I had to go I had to go get him out of jail.
Yeah.
And I was a junior officer, so I got the good jobs, like going out and getting my man out of jail.
Yeah.
And then I had to stand with him on the captain's mast, when he was getting punished.
Yeah.
Of course, I had to say good things about him.
Yeah. So what kind of punishment
did
they
have? He thought I was, I was really a great guy. I'd get him out of jail and stand up for him.
Yeah.
Oh, usually something like that. It was a civilian offense, really, for stealing something.
Yeah.
I don't remember what he got, maybe 30 days on board ship.
Yeah.
Restricted to ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think he finally won AWOL. He was a pretty good sailor while I was there. We had a petty officer he had worked his way up to a chief petty officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty good in the Navy.
Yeah.
During the war, and as soon as the war was over, during the war he couldn't get in any trouble. They couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't get any trouble. You could get a little drunk once in a while, they just throw you back in the boat and take you back on ship. And you sober up. So, that wasn't a big offense there.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept getting in scrapes. He'd get drunk and get in scrapes when we were after the war. We were in town someplace. Then you get drunk and get in trouble.
Right.
And he got in trouble and they kept breaking him down. And he went from a chief petty officer down to a second class seaman.
That's too bad.
It's awful.
Yeah.
But.
Now what was your final grade when you left the Navy?
Lieutenant JG.
Okay.
I never got any higher.
Yeah.
They told me if I signed on, they'd make me a lieutenant.
You had no interest in signing on anymore.
No, I should have signed on for another year and gotten to be a lieutenant, but I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. You had your Navy feel, huh?
Yeah. I thought I'd done my job by then.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your
Besides,
service.
They had me standing these watches, one and three all the time, and that would drive me up the wall.
Yeah. Didn't want to stay there, huh?
You go 6 months and you'd never get a full night's sleep.
Yeah. That's not healthy
so
for
you. So you either had to... had to watch from 8 till midnight, mm-hmm. or you had it from midnight till 4, or from 4 a.m. till 7.
Yeah.
You had one of those watches every night, mm-hmm. so you never got a whole night's sleep.
Yeah. Hmm. So do you still like to be on a boat now, or?
Oh, sure, I still like to see. I take cruises now and then.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, those cruise ships aren't too much like a ship.
I wouldn't think so. I would hope not, anyway. Not for what you have to pay for them.
Yeah, the Navy ships are a little cruder looking in the insides. You know, and if you have a light plug, mm-hmm. There's the plug, and you see how it's put on the wall, and you see where the wire goes up, and
you know? There wasn't any secrets there. So all told, and how long did you serve in the Navy then?
Well, I think they had me down for about 6.5 years for the 2 R's.
Hmm.
And I guess I got something for the reserve in between.
In between, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, thank you so much for your interview today. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say about your service and your time there?
No. I think frankly, it would probably help most young men to serve a tour, to be in the service.
Or women.
It won't help them if they got shot, but I mean, otherwise, I think it would
help them to discipline.
It's a pretty good experience.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, being an officer is better than being an enlisted man.
So you would recommend doing that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So that was both.
Well, thank you again for your interview today.
Right.
I appreciate it. I'm going to push.